This is Bird Note. Mother Goose sounds old-fashioned, so let's bring her story up to date. Everyone knows Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty. They're Disney stories, right? Not exactly. 3 centuries before they helped make Disney famous, they were among the original Mother Goose tales. And hundreds of classic nursery rhymes, like Three Blind Mice and Humpty Dumpty, were also first gathered under Mother Goose's wing. Such stories and rhymes were long part of Europe's oral folklore. The stories were first published in France in 1697 as Tales of My Mother Goose. The book appeared in English soon after. Just who or what was Mother Goose? The name originates in an old French euphemism. Stories told by elder women were called Tales Told by Mother Goose. Mother Goose was sometimes illustrated as an old country woman wearing a tall hat and riding on the back of a goose, or sometimes as just a big motherly goose wearing reading glasses and a bonnet, a friendly figure children could trust. There's something timeless about big feathery friends for children, even today. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. This episode is brought to you by Wild Delight Bird Food, which aims to support wild bird populations with clean, nutritious ingredients in every blend. Available at Chewy.com.
If you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. We at New Dimensions thank you for your support. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
Useful in this time of global uncertainty? Humility, creativity, empathy, activism. What keeps me from despair is singing in a chorus with others. These days, over remote connection, as we breathe together and blend our voices in harmony. Along with singing, poetry keeps the wolves from my door. Good poems soften my heart and help me face another day with curiosity, wonder, and hope. A good poem gives me another lens in which to view the world. Poetry helps bring what is often unseen into view. It can be the observation of a single ant making its way across a laptop computer, or turtles in moonlight. Poetry can open us to feel our connection to one another and to nature. It gives us the opportunity to recalibrate our perspective on our place in the world. Today, we'll be exploring the power of poetry in these stressful and turbulent times with our guest, Jane Hirschfield. Jane Hirschfield is the author of 9 books of poetry and 2 collections of essays, and has edited and co-translated 4 books presenting the work of world poets from the past. Her books have received the Poetry Center Book Award, the California Book Award, and the Donnell Hall Jane Kenyon Prize of American Poetry. Her poems appear in a wide range of prestigious outlets. A resident of Northern California, she's a Chancellor Emerita of the Academy of American Poets. She presents her work at literary and interdisciplinary events worldwide. Her most recent book of poetry is entitled Ledger. I'm speaking with Jane Hirschfield at her home in Northern California by remote connection. Please join us for the next hour as we explore how poems can be stepping stones on a map to wonder with our guest, Jane Hirschfield. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Welcome, Jane.
I'm so pleased to be here with you, Justine. Thank you.
I'm so pleased to have you once more. I would like to begin by asking you about the title of this new book of poetry, Ledger. What is the significance of that title?
I've been feeling the past few years with all of their crises, let alone the current one of the pandemic, as an absolutely unaccountable time. It is unfathomable to me that the crisis of the biosphere, the fracturing of our sense of shared fate and social connection have been going on in the way that they have. And so when you're facing into an unaccountable time, the only thing I know to do is to try to take some account of it. And so this is a book, very much a ledger book, is an accounting. It's an accounting of the darkness. It's an attempt to find my way, which I really had to do, navigating poem by poem over these years, to some sense of the balance between the recognition of cataclysm and the appreciation of this still beautiful world with its abundance of treasures and gifts that I still open my eyes into every day. And so it's a ledger of perhaps despair and praise.
Despair and praise, two kind of on a teeter-totter as we kind of are tossed hither and yon between the two, I think. I'm reminded of, there was an interview that you gave to Colleen Morgan Bush at Orion Magazine. She wrote that you had said this. It really struck me. You said after writing some poems that really kind of would be the despair part of the teeter-totter, and you said that in writing within that poem, what arose in you was that it's simply rude not to be grateful for the praise, for and praise all the beauty still now with us. And then you go on to talk about Out Your Window. Do you recall that, and could you...
I recall the interview, but much more I recall the experience. And it has to do with two very specific poems in the book, both of which were written quite late in the book. And so the poem which led to that realization was one called Ghazal for the End of Time. And it's the darkest poem I have ever written. It frightened me. And it left me astonished that I could even arrive at where the poem arrives at, and wondering, how could I feel this way? It was shocking to me. But the recognition of the shock came after I had described to a friend, I'd said, I just wrote the most frightening thing I've ever written. And she said, oh, can I see it? And so I emailed it off to her. And in the interval between sending it to her and hearing back from her was when I entered the realization of the sheer rudeness of only despairing when this generous existence is still a fabric that I am part of, that we all are part of. And out of that shock came what became the last poem in the book, a poem called My Debt, in which I quite explicitly apologize to the world for writing, as the poem says, in such black ink. I can read you the two poems if you
want. I would love that. I'm sure our listeners would too. Thank you.
So to begin our conversation with the most frightening and darkest poem I have ever written, I should tell listeners, because the word ghazal is probably not familiar to everyone, that a ghazal is an Urdu or Persian poetry form written in long couplets with repeating words at the end of many of the lines. This is a loose ghazal. It is not following the form in any way perfectly, but that's rather the point. And the title, Ghazal for the End of Time, is also an allusion to the famous piece of music written by Messiaen when he was in a prisoner of war camp, Quartet for the End of Time. Break anything, a window, a pie crust, a glacier, it will break open. A voice cannot speak, cannot sing, without lips, teeth, lamina propria, coming open. Some breakage can barely be named, hardly be spoken. Rains stopped, roof said. Fires, forests, cities, cellars peeled open. Tears stopped, eyes said. An unhearable music fell instead from them, a clarinet stripped of its breathing, the cello abandoned. The violin grieving, a hand too long empty held open. The imperial piano, its 89th, 90th, 91st strings, unsummoned, unwoken. Watching, listening was like that. The low, wordless humming of being unwoven. Fish vanished. Bees vanished, bats whitened, Arctic ice opened. Hands wanted more time, hands thought we had time. Spending time's rivers, its meadows, its mountains, its instruments tuning their silence, its deep mantle broken. Earth stumbled within and outside us. Orca, thistle, kestrel, withheld their instruction. Rock said, burning ones, pry your own blindness open. Death said, now I too am orphan. So the ledger side of this poem is the side of absolute climate catastrophe. And I believe that we will not change our ways, our human choices, until we fully take in the consequence of where we are headed. And I know the poem, it does exaggerate. You know, not everything will die. There are resilient species, cockroaches, rats, even human beings are resilient species. But that last statement of the poem, the idea that death itself might be orphaned if there were no living microbe left for it to inhabit, that terrified me. And when I sent the poem to my friend, I thought, how can I darken her day with these thoughts? And so, shaken in a way by this blackness of future envisionment, I then wrote this next poem, My Debt.
And before we read that, because we'll run out of time in this segment, I wanted to just say about that, those last words before we move on to the next poem, death said, now I too am an orphan, just radiates. It just like hits us in the heart, in the chest. And that, that phrase, it's just curious how it even came to you that to talk about even death is an orphan.
Well, the thing about writing a poem is I never know how anything comes to me. This poem was so sound-driven that part of why the word orphan came was because it rhymes with open and broken and summon and all of those others. But this is the deep collaboration of language, music, psyche, ideas, that you end up saying things you wouldn't say without the music of poetry supporting you.
I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Jane Hirschfield, and she is the author of Ledger, a book of poetry, and her newest edition, her newest book of poems. I'm Justine Willis-Toms, and you're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with poet Jane Hirschfield, and she is the author of many books of poetry, including Ledger. And we're talking about two poems, one that shows us the teeter-totter of despair, and now we're going to go into a second poem that's kind of a, gives us more hope. Can you talk about this one and then read it, please?
So My Debt is the poem I think of as the bookend poem to Ghazal for the End of Time. And it's also the final poem in the book. And so I believe it's appropriate when one is taking a ledger of one's relationship to existence and one's sense of existence, even in this most catastrophic time, quietly catastrophic for some of us, the lucky of us, but universally catastrophic, to end your ledger with the sense of debt to the world feels to me quite appropriate. In your introductory remarks, you used the word humility, and that has been for me a word much in my mind for some years now. And I think one needs to embrace a sense of humility even in the face of one's own despair. You have to be humble about your despair. I can't know what's going to happen to the world. None of us knows what's going to happen to the world. There's an earlier poem in the book, I Wanted to Be Surprised. This coronavirus has surprised us all. One of the odd things it's shown us is it is possible for all humanity to decide to do something together and pretty much do it. Who would have thought we could make such a change so quickly as we have?
You know, I often think about the coronavirus as the power of the small. I mean, yes. It took the smallest that we can't even see it with our eyes, the power of this smallest life form to bring us all to this interconnection. You talk about humility, and I know humility, you've said in at other times that it loosens the delusion of separateness.
Yes. of separateness and of self-importance. But I think I should read the poem and we should come back to these things.
Oh, good.
Our listeners will have forgotten what we're talking about.
Thank you.
So here's the poem, My Debt. Like all who believe in the senses, I was an accountant, copyist, statistician, not registrar, witness, permitted to touch the leaf of a thistle, the trembling work of a spider, to ponder the Hubble's recordings. It did not matter if I believed in the party of particle or of wave, as I carried no weapon. It did not matter if I believed. I weighed ashes, actions, cities that glittered like rubies on the scales I was given, calibrated in units of fear and amazement. I wrote the word it, the word is. I entered the debt that is owed to the real. Forgive, spine-covered leaf, soft-bodied spider, octopus lifting one curious tentacle back toward the hand of the diver, that in such black ink I set down your flammable colors.
So many images, that very delicate arm of the octopus coming and embracing the diver, the bodied of the spider, so many wonderful images. So expand on that and how we were talking about humility and how poems help us really tunnel down into some sort of depth of spirit.
Well, I think that one of the things poems allow us to recognize is the parity and the interconnection between the most minute and humble and the most large, for lack of a better word, I will say numinous. And so, you know, this poem moves from one thistle leaf to the cosmos we can see in the photographs taken by the Hubble. And this is not a vast separation. This is a vast connection. And I think that is one of the things poetry is almost uniquely able to recognize, enact, praise, bring to awareness, that nothing is too small, nothing is too large to be brought into one way of meeting, embracing, greeting, being sustained by the full scope of existence.
That reminds me, as you're talking about the power of the small and so forth, that there was a poem that you had that went viral that we all just, I particularly, the you know, in noticing that which is very small. I'd love for you to share the poem, When I Can Do Nothing, what it's called, what?
Today When I Could Do Nothing.
Yes.
And this was a poem written, my book Ledger came out, its pub date was March 10th. And that means, as we poets do, because everybody thinks of poets as sitting quietly at their desks, what we do when a book comes out and we're asked to is we start flying around wildly. So I did a reading in New York City at the 92nd Street Y. I did a reading in Chicago at the Poetry Foundation. I did a reading in Seattle at the magnificent Elliott Bay Bookstore. Seattle at that time was the epicenter of the virus in this country. When I flew home, I was supposed to do a reading at our local bookstore, Book Passage, and that was canceled by then, and everything going forward was canceled. Because I'd been in Seattle and I'd been on a lot of airplanes and in hotel rooms using my hand sanitizer and my disinfectant wipes, you know, every step of the way, I pretty much went into self-quarantine on March 12th. But on March 16th, they announced the Bay Area 6-county shelter in place, which was the first in the country, beginning March 17th. And I woke up that morning to a deeply quiet world. All of the usual hubbub of civilization was gone. You couldn't hear cars, you couldn't hear construction. Even the airplanes seemed quieter by then. And I sat on my window seat and noticed what became this poem. Today, when I could do nothing. Today, when I could do nothing, I saved an ant. It must have come in with the morning paper, still being delivered to those who shelter in place. A morning paper is still an essential service. I am not an essential service. I have coffee and books, time, a garden, silence enough to fill cisterns. It must have first walked the morning paper, as if loosened ink taking the shape of an ant, then across the laptop computer, warm, then onto the back of a cushion. Small black ant, alone, crossing a navy cushion, moving steadily because that is what it could do. Set outside in the sun, it could not have found again its nest. What then did I save? It did not move as if it was frightened, even while walking my hand, which moved it through swiftness and air. Ant, alone, without companions, whose ant heart I could not fathom. How is your life? I wanted to ask. I lifted it, took it outside. This first day when I could do nothing, contribute nothing beyond staying distant from my own kind, I did this.
I was so struck by the idea that the part where it's an individual ant and it's not going back into the place that it left, so to speak. And will it find its companions again? Will it be able to hone in? Oh, they're very, very smart. So possibly it will find its nest again. But it made me have compassion for that ant and the isolation it might have felt for a moment when it got transferred to some other place.
Well, I think that is very much what each of us who was suddenly separated into our own homes without our communities, I think, you know, I might have rescued the ant on any other day as well, but the tenderness I felt for it that day, alone, out of place, separated from its colony, I think that was affected by this large picture. And the great contrast between my window seat, me, the newspaper, my laptop, and what I knew was going on in the broader world, and the great suffering of the broader world, which in a human being, and I don't take special credit for this, I think in a normal, undamaged human being, when you see suffering, you want to do anything you can to alleviate it. And the only thing I could do was try to give that ant its life back.
I'm reminded of a quote from Martin Shaw, who is a storyteller from England and a mythologist. And he says, the world pushes you into poetry by withdrawing something, not giving it. The greatest poems are not written by the woman who got the last kiss. They're written by the woman who didn't.
This is very true. I think poems are, especially for me perhaps, they are life rafts. They are a rope thrown to the person on the cliff ledge. They are acts of rescue. And some of them more obviously than others, some of them more desperately than others, some of them more lightly and delicately than others. But every good poem that I read in the world feels to me like a recalibration of that ledger of